Hello, Brandon. Welcome to this guest episode of East is a Podcast. I am your guest MC, Max Isle, although in the Arab region, Max Agile. And we will be discussing your beautiful new monograph, The Paranoid Style in American Diplomacy, about U.S. regime changes and struggles against it for national liberation and economic sovereignty in Iraq, a book that I, as you know, also read as a dissertation. So it's cool to see it. And thank you for coming on today.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm a big fan of the show. As I say, a longtime listener, first time caller. So it's a great honor to be here and get to talk about the book.
So give us what academics refer to as the elevator pitch for your book. What's up with it? Why did you write it?
Okay, well, the elevator pitch and why did I write it? Maybe those are two different questions, but I guess the elevator pitch is that it's kind of a straightforward story of the Iraqi struggle to nationalize, to take over the Iraq Petroleum Company between really the 1950s and when that succeeded in the early 1970s. So it's just the story of how Iraqis came to take over their national oil resources. And it's about the U.S. Diplomacy, the U.S. state's effort to stop that if possible. And it's about the relationship between the multinational oil companies and the American state, how the companies might seek support from the state to fend off the threat of nationalization. Why I wrote the book is maybe an older story in the sense that the book was written in the, or at least the research was conducted in the early 2000s in the backdrop of the Iraq War. I started formulating this project in response to the Iraq War. I transferred to UC Santa Cruz to from community college to complete my BA degree in 2000. Two. And so I was entering college, finishing my undergraduate degree right as the ramp up to the war was beginning. And I really wanted to know some of the backstory, the deep history of U.S. involvement in the region and what might be animating U.S. foreign policy there. So I suppose what got me interested in the book was wanting to know the longer history of U.S.-Iraqi relations. And I chose to focus in on oil. And don't actually cover the recent history. I get up to the mid-70s. But that's the impetus anyway.
So can you walk us through this a little bit? One of the bookends, as it were, of the book itself, or temporally speaking, is the 1958 revolution, which I think is something relatively unknown. I don't think I knew enough about it until later on in life, and especially I don't think I understood its impact until I was actually going through newspaper articles from 1958 in Tunisia. And it was suddenly clear 1958 revolution in Iraq was like actually a major world systemic revolution that we don't even know happened generally, and even in, I think, more educated public sphere in the United States, for example.
Yeah, well, I think it really was an important kind of watershed world historical event in the sense, especially because the Hashemite monarchy was the linchpin or was such a central pillar of the Baghdad Pact, of the regional security architecture that the United States had in place. And so it was the fall of a regime that the United States and Britain had come to rely on or depend on. So it was an important sort of geopolitical event in the kind of Nasserist pan-Arabist moment of the 1950s. And as I argue in the book, it opened up this process of embarking down the road of nationalizing the oil. You know, Iraqi civil servants and nationalists had favored, had been arguing for, advocating for national control over Iraqi oil resources since the 1920s, since the inception of the Iraqi state. But it was the 1958 revolution that opened the path to institution building, building the institutions, building the international sort of relationships to allow for the nationalization to happen. So 1958 is kind of the proverbial dam breaking way and opening up to a new period, a new process. So yeah, 58 is a big deal, an important revolution, one we should pay more attention to.
For your account, how do you periodize these various moments? Like you have 1958, you have the U.S. coup, early 60s. Then, in fact, I wanna go into that more. You know, for some people, it's kind of like there was a revolution and then there was a coup, and then, you know, these struggles over nationalization kind of fall into the background to be replaced by this kind of demonic figure of Saddam Hussein. But you tell both a story that says a lot more about the absolutely shitty and nefarious U.S. role, right? But then also a story that, in fact, shows that as shitty, as nefarious as it was, they couldn't come close to achieving their objectives through that coup, and that a lot of liberatory spirit endured, not just on a mass level, but institutionally afterwards. So can you walk us through that a little bit?
Yeah, so that's a key theme, is the idea that this is a kind of a failed intervention on the part of the United States. Like, this is a Iraqi nationalist ultimately triumphing or prevailing over U.S. efforts to try to obstruct or block the nationalization of the oil. So in that sense, it's a story of Iraqis triumphing over U.S. interventionism. Let's see. So the beginning of that question was, I'm sorry, go back just a second. What was the start of that question? Had to do with 1958 and the different groups that brought it about, or how 58 brings us to the 63 coup?
Yeah, the various elements that were active from 58 to 63. And then I want to go into the coup itself, because I think you've said some critically important things in some of the subsequent discussion around your book that I want to get into.
Okay, yeah, so I think it's helpful to think about the different groups. If we take from Hanna Batatu's, you know, magisterial study, the old social classes, I think he has, in the revolutionary movements of Iraq, you know, there are three main sort of groups we want to keep an eye on when we think about Iraqi politics, the 1950s. You have the communists, which are the, you know, the oldest, the most well-organized, the most popular, the most secular, the most progressive and advanced political grouping in the country. You have the Baathists, who are, you know, kind of a more elite, top-down, professional-oriented party. And then you have the free officers. So you have the kind of, who are kind of not ideologically more pragmatic, less inclined, that will kind of you know, gravitate between the Baathists and the communists. And so there are these three kind of revolutionary groupings. And they come together in the mid-1950s over opposition to the Baghdad Pact, which is this security umbrella bringing, you know, Iraq into a regional defensive alliance, mainly against Egypt, under the idea that Egypt was somehow a proxy or a client of the Soviet Union. And so the Baghdad Pact and the Eisenhower Doctrine after the 1956 Suez War, when the United States and the Eisenhower administration and John Foster Dulles in particular worried that Nasser was gaining too much influence in the region, introduced the Eisenhower Doctrine, which was the idea of providing military and economic aid to Jordan, to Iraq, and to Saudi Arabia, to the conservative Arab states that were going to stand against Nasser. And U.S. support for these conservatives in the region really brought together these opposition groups, the Baathists and the communists, under the direction of the free officers. That coalition comes together to overthrow the Hashemite monarchy. But then immediately after the 1958 coup, you know, divisions emerge between the communists on the one side and the Baathists on the other, and Qasem trying to navigate between the two of them. And so it's ultimately the split between the communists and the Baathists that allows the United States to exploit that split and throw its weight behind the Baath as the Baath started to move towards a coup. And, you know, it takes until 1963 for the Baath to eventually overthrow Qasem. So we can go into a little more detail about how that came together if you'd like.
Actually, before going into that, what I want you to talk about more also is to tell us more about the bath during this period, because I know about the Arab region, but also, you know, in Tunisia, the bath was the major radical criminalized Arab nationalist movement that evolved into Marxism and so forth. And now people are like, bath is just like torturing babies. But like, actually, it was so much more complicated than even though they were U.S. supported, obviously, at that time. So can you talk a little bit about what it meant then to be a bathy? Because it has a very different denotation than the common popular connotation, I think.
Yeah, okay, that's a good question. And one thing that's interesting about that is that there are multiple baths, right? There are all these different sort of tendencies and valences and sort of groupings and periods and eras within the party. So the party in 2003 or the party in, you know, today is different than maybe when it was first organized. So one thing to say that I think was useful as I thought through the different groupings in Iraq was that the Ba'ath started as a modern educated doctors, lawyers, saw themselves as a kind of vanguard elite, and their model of political change, as the literature tells us, was the inquilab, was the coup, cultivating ties through the military and exerting a sudden decisive force in politics that didn't involve a large-scale mobilization of society, because their idea was that there's an organic unity between the, you know, industrial bourgeoisie and the Arab society was unified, rich and poor. The class dimension was not one that they weren't emphasizing the class dimension. I'm sort of trying to contrast here with the idea of the communists was the thawra, was revolution, mobilization from below. And so you have kind of a top-down versus a bottom-up orientation of the two parties, right? So the Ba'ath started with this kind of elitist bias, which is part of the story. So the Ba'ath in the immediate 1956, 1957, 1958 period was advocating for immediate union with Egypt, wanting to join with the United Arab Republic, right? With Syria and Egypt joining in February 1958 and Yemen coming along afterwards. So the Ba'ath wanted to join after the 1958 revolution, the Ba'ath wanted to join with Egypt and Syria, wanted to immediately join the United Arab Republic. Whereas the communists were reluctant to want to join United Arab Republic. They certainly had respect for Nasser as a symbol of anti-imperialism and having stood up to the French, Israeli, British invasion of the Suez in 1956. But the Iraqi communists did not want to surrender Iraqi sovereignty. Particularly, they did not want to submerge Iraq in its sort of ethnic linguistic and religious sort of diversity within a kind of a pan-Arab state, which they thought would be dominated by Sunni, more conservative Sunni Arabs. And so you had this dispute that breaks out immediately after the 1958 revolution. You have Qasem, who sort of leans towards the communists, that wants to maintain Iraq's independence and not join with the United Arab Republic, and you have the Ba'athists who want to join the UAR immediately. And Qasem, the president, the leader, is more inclined towards the communists and not wanting to join with UAR. And his vice president or his second in command is Arif. Arif is not a member of the Ba'ath, but is sympathetic to their movement and wants to join with the UAR. Immediately. So right away, you get a split between the top leadership of the revolution, with Qasem, not a member of the communists, but sympathetic to their movement and favoring of the communists, and Arif, the second in command, being more sympathetic towards the Ba'ath and the idea of submerging Iraq in a pan-Arab state. So very early on, you know, the revolution is July, and by August and September, there's already, you know, Arif has already been jailed for trying to overthrow Qasem and bring Iraq into a United Arab Republic. So that split happens immediately. And it creates a really difficult situation for the United States to figure out what side of this factional split they see their interests as most closely aligned with.
So communism during this era, right, in the Arab East especially, was being articulated by the Shia community predominantly, right? This is part of the problem, is that there was a way that they were worried that the Arab nationalism was going to re-entrench their, not only their minoritarian status, but the relative social deprivation and disempowerment of the Shia community, right? I mean, which has reverberations to this day, right? For example, in Lebanon, and difficulties of convergence between Arab nationalism and communism.
Yeah, so Shia for sure, but also, you know, Kurds and Assyrian Christians and other sort of religious minorities and others, you know, so the Communist Party drew to its ranks. So as I mentioned, the Ba'ath, one of the differences between the Ba'ath and the Communists is that the Ba'ath draws its ranks. Its ranks are very small. There's like maybe only 300 party members at the time of the 1958 coup. And they're all sort of doctors, lawyers, engineered, you know, very, you know, elite stratum. Whereas the communists are, you know, workers and peasants, right? Port workers and railway workers and oil workers. And so so one thing that's different about the Communist Party is that its ranks are filled with workers and peasants. And so it favors that kind of mobilization from below, right? Transforming society by mobilizing. And a lot of those, you know, port and railway and, you know, oil workers and are not Sunni Arabs, right? That, you know, you're talking about Shiites and Kurds and Christians and, you know, different religious minorities that were drawn to the Communist Party. And so the Communist Party was a kind of more pluralistic and more inclusive, at least that's the way it was understood and why it was able to draw to its ranks a kind of more diverse constituency that saw the Iraqi nation state as a better vehicle to represent their interests than a pan-Arab state that would be, you know, dominated by Egypt and Nasser.